For many of us, this time of year means queuing up a different Christmas movie for each night between Thanksgiving and December 25th. From this podcast point of view, each and every one of these holiday films acts as a document of its respective era, the same as any other primary source. Welcome to the Everything is a Primary Source podcast. I'm your host, Eric Paul. Love Actually turned 20 last month and has been included on my household's must-view list for the past two decades. It holds a special place for my wife and I because we saw it in the theater during our very first Christmas season as a couple. I couldn't think of a better person, therefore, to help me break down this modern holiday classic as a document of 2003 than her. I only wanted to do this dissection of Love Actually with you because we saw this movie together in the theater, didn't we?
Yes, we did.
And by talking about it, it really brings us back to 2003, Christmas season of 2003. And in those days, less so than now, the mall was the place to be to do everything, shopping, and then at the end of the day, and this is like what we did that day, was I remember we shopped at the, it was called the Carousel Mall then, now it's Destiny USA in Syracuse, New York, and then caught a movie. Do you remember that day as fondly as I do?
Probably not as clearly as you do, just because I don't have the best memory, but I do remember going to see this, and I remember walking around the mall and seeing all the decorations.
Yeah, and it almost like matched the movie because like one thing I always think about with Love Actually is it's very like clean and pristine. Every like all the characters, all the settings with the exception of a few are like really well organized and there's a lot of like white involved in it. It's very like bright and put together. I think Colin is really the only exception to that. He's kind of a mess, but the guy ends up coming to America and everything. But and malls looked like that back then too, especially that one. It was like bright, brand new, you know, cutting edge mall. And were you looking forward to this movie when it was coming out? Like, did you know about it and what to expect?
Yeah, I knew about it beforehand because, you know, I had been a fan of Colin Firth for so long. And I believe that you and I had already seen a Colin Firth movie together because I asked you to go see What a Girl Wants with me. And yeah. You didn't even know who Colin Firth was.
I thought it was the kid.
Like the teenage kid.
I'm like, this
and
guy?
Yeah, that's not at all. So I knew about this movie coming out and I knew it was going to be like a Christmas romantic comedy with Colin Firth and, of course, Hugh Grant. And I mean, I had already loved both of them together in the Bridget Jones Diary movie. And so I was like, oh, great, another one. Like, it seemed like there was a little bit of a slight resurgence of like British comedies or something at that point, because like I said, What a Girl Wants actually starred an American actress, Amanda Bynes, who goes to England to find her birth father, and it's Colin Firth. And of course, we'd already had Bridget Jones because the books were so successful.
With Colin Firth.
Yeah, by Helen Fielding. And actually, Colin Firth is a character in the books. It's kind of metafictional because Bridget Jones loves the Pride and Prejudice series. Mm. And so she talks about, you know, watching that series and, you know, having Colin Firth in it. But then at some point, I think in the second book, Colin Firth himself as an actor makes an appearance. Yeah. So it's kind of funny. And then, of course, this one came out. So it was like this, like, oh, okay, we're looking at British comedy, or what we think of as British comedy, I guess, more than actual British comedy. Because when I try to watch actual British comedy, like Benny Hill and stuff, I really don't get it at all. But this was like the American version of British comedy. Because it's very relatable to us, but it features all these beloved British actors with, of course, their charming accents. So
this is a very transatlantic movie. There's a lot of Americanism in it. A lot of Americans, even. One of the most pivotal part of the movie is when the president of the United States comes to visit, and that changes a lot for, I mean, it's really hard to say is there a main character at all. There's really no main character.
No, there's not really a main character, but it's funny because this story, or this movie does feature a lot of Americanism and a number of Americans as, like, in it. But a lot of the Americans aren't portrayed in a great way.
No.
I mean, like, you just mentioned the president, who was played by, what's his
Billy
face? Billy Bob Thornton, yeah. I mean, it seems like it's kind of referring to, you know,
Bush. He's like a mashup of George Bush and Bill Clinton. Because yeah. He's like womanizer.
Like, he kind of resembles, you know, George W. Bush, but the way that he's like a womanizer is a little bit more of a reference to Clinton.
Yeah.
So I guess either way, I mean, they're kind of not making out the American president to be the nicest guy or the most upstanding citizen. And, you know, when Colin goes over to America and he meets the American girls in the bar,
yeah.
They're not really the best representation of American women either.
And Laura Linney's character is American, but they never really explain. She like kind of mentions it a few times that her and her brother, who's not well, as she puts it,
yeah.
They're in England. They don't really explain if she.
She says something at one point, like sort of there not being any parents anymore. Like yeah. You're supposed to understand that the parents have passed on, so now she is her brother's only caretaker. Like if it wasn't for her, nobody yeah. would be there to take care of him.
And she works at a design company, so maybe she worked in the American office of that, and this is like her aspirations to, you know. And I actually like that they don't over-explain a lot of these characters. You just kind of like meet them in the middle of their lives. Like they're not, you know, we don't get a lot of
exposition. Like you're looking at them through a window. You know, you don't need their whole backstory. You're just kind of walking up. You're seeing a window into this very specific time.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's it. I mean, like, they don't even all have, like, resolutions because we don't even need to see what the exact, resolution is for every single yeah. story. But just the time that you're seeing them is, like, enjoyable.
And the airport is a major component of this. The movie starts and ends with airport life and culture. And that's where really the only other American that has a good story to them and or like is, you know, is when the little boy is chasing after the girl he has a crush on, and yeah. she's American, she's heading
Joanna.
Back, you know, and he's trying to catch up with her, and she's heading back to the United States, and you know, it's like it's all he can do to finally get her right before she boards her plane and everything and tell her how he feels. And she and her mom are like really the only two Americans that seem to be like, you know, they put together and, you know,
yeah,
like good representation.
I feel like there is a little bit of a subtext there, though. I mean, she's a very cute girl and obviously, like, it's an adorable love story. But even the way that, like, even though he says that, you know, she's wonderful and he's in love with her and everything, the way that she's kind of portrayed, at least at first, is like, she doesn't even know he exists.
Yeah.
Like she's that self-important that it's like, you know, and I kind of feel like a lot of countries see America that way. Like we're so caught up in our own fabulousness
yeah.
that we don't bother to look around us and
well,
see
yeah,
what other people might be thinking.
A lot of the actors in this are, if you look at their IMDb, you know, they have so, like their list of British TV shows and movies is endless. And then a few American ones like, oh, Alan Rickman. I loved him in Quigley Down Under and Robin Hood and Harry Potter movies. And then there's like a bunch of other stuff. He's and Die Hard, you know,
yeah.
he's in that. And
I mean, oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
But yeah, and he's pretty accomplished on both sides. But a lot of these actors that we're looking at right now, you know, Keira Knightley's on the screen. She was just barely cracking into American.
Yeah, she's only 19 here. And I think that, I mean, this obviously followed the success of Bend It Like Beckham, which was like a breakout hit.
Yeah.
For her.
And I wonder if there's something to this, because Richard Curtis is the director. He wrote the movie as well. And he's also behind the Bridget Jones movies.
Oh, well, yeah, that makes sense. Then.
And, you know, he uses an American actress to play a British woman in that. But the biggest foil for Bridget Jones in that movie is the American that comes in and has an affair with
yeah.
Hugh Grant's character, and they always refer, you know, the Americans are crushing us, and you know, it's like this is like an era that early 2000s seems to be for Britain anyway. It's opportunity to really highlight that, and this movie contains a scene like that where they highlight, well, we're great too. Like we have some really great contributions too.
Well, it's interesting that you say that. I have actually two things to respond to. So one, yes, you're right. The British actors in here, I mean, like I said, I've been a fan of Colin Firth for years, And at one point I decided I'm going to see every single movie that Colin Firth has ever made. And when I went to his like IMDb, there were so many movies that I'd never even heard of that I couldn't even find. Cause you know, this was back in the days of having to rent the tape or the DVD and I couldn't find them anywhere. Like there's still tons of his movies that I haven't seen or haven't even had the opportunity to see.
Yeah.
Just because, and there's a couple that I did manage to find. And I, again, I couldn't relate to them. They were very, very British, not like our American version of British.
Right.
But the other thing, now that you mentioned that about Bridget Jones and like the biggest foil for her in her movie is, you know, the American that steals her, you know, who she thinks of as her boyfriend away. I read the Bridget Jones's books, and although that is a character in there, Laura, but I don't remember there being that much talk about America in the books. I mean, like Helen Fielding, I feel like the books are just a lot more about Bridget keeping her diary. You know, she's always concerned about how much she smokes and how much she weighs and her crazy family, because her family's a much bigger, like, presence in the books. Mm-hmm. But yeah, now that you say that, I don't remember there being nearly that much talk about the Americans doing this or the Americans doing that in the books. I feel like that might be something that's just in the movie.
And it might have everything to do with the wide release of both these movies and all these movies that he does, because Notting Hill is one of his as well. Four Weddings and a Funeral, right? Yeah, it's Four Weddings and a Funeral, not Four Funerals and a Wedding. But that, you know, all those Hugh Grant movies, you know, from the late 90s and stuff, these are all Richard Curtis. And with Notting Hill, he has Julia Roberts in that. Andy
McDowell's sweetheart.
And is another, you know, sweetheart, Andy McDowell's in Four Weddings and a Funeral. And it's like they want to have that connection to America, but they don't, it's not a movie for Americans, if that makes sense. Like they're not trying to, it's Britain on display, and there's plenty of it. Well, that being said, I, like you were saying with the Colin Firth movies, and as you know, I'm a huge fan of the original UK Office. And when I bought the DVD for the first series of the UK Office, it came with a insert of British to American translations, because there's so many references in just one episode of that show of celebrities or terminology, lingo that is, you don't need to explain it to British people because it's part of their lexicon. But Americans, I'm like, I have no idea what they're talking about. And so it's like, we have to kind of keep learning about it. As we're talking, one of the characters from, one of the actors from The Office, who plays Tim, Martin Freeman, is on the screen right now in one of several stories of Love Actually. And this movie doesn't have quite that depth of Britishism in it that we have to get a dictionary out. Like, I remember being in the theater and getting along with the movie pretty well. I understood what was happening, even if some of their accents were hard to understand necessarily. It wasn't, I think the biggest thing that threw us off, and we said it right away, and every time we watch this, is the opening where it says 5 weeks till Christmas.
Yeah, I always, because in, you know, in the U.S. we don't really consider the Christmas season starting until after Thanksgiving. That is like the official start. And I remember like 5 weeks, like they haven't even had Thanksgiving yet. But then I thought, oh wait, they don't do Thanksgiving.
It's not the same way.
Not the same way on the same day that we do. I mean, maybe they have their own version of something like that. But I mean, one of the other things, I'm not a huge fan of The Office. I've just never been able to get into it. But I do enjoy the other series that Ricky Gervais was part of, which was Extras.
Yeah.
And we have watched the American version of that and then kind of gone back and seen some of, like, this, I guess I shouldn't say the American version, but when it came to America, they replaced some of the references with ones that we would understand more. Like the whole thing with the Kramer doll.
Yeah.
That's for the American audience, right? Because everybody knows what Michael Richards said and they got in big trouble and stuff like that. But I believe the original version was some British celebrity that we had no idea what they were talking
when
about.
When we access Extras now, because I have the DVD of that as well. And the DVD, speaking of early 2000s, because HBO and BBC 4, I think, because the companies that made Extras produced it. So there's most of the episodes are exactly the same no matter who's watching them. But you're right, certain references like that one. And then there's the other one, the episode with Daniel Radcliffe in it, where they mention, in the American version, they say Halle Berry. But then in the British version, it's a British actress that they mention.
Oh, I don't remember that it's, one. I mean, I know the episode.
When you access it on streaming, you'll get the British version of it. And so it's like almost like 98% of it is the same. And I feel that this movie is a similar thing too, where and we're about to see the first appearance, I think, of Laura Linney's character, where it's just kind of like, all right, after minutes of just British people, suddenly we have our American on the screen and we can understand her. You know, she's one of us. And I think they probably, in editing this movie, like peppered in just enough because they knew that they wanted an American audience to watch this. It wasn't just going to be a British movie only. I'd like to take this opportunity to remind you about my website, everythinghistory.com. It is the one stop to follow this podcast and to check out my socials, including YouTube and especially Instagram. Also at everythinghistory.com, you'll find a list of my consulting and coaching offerings with video tutorials to arrive soon. Head on over to everythinghistory.com. That's everything-history.com. And now back to the conversation. So, I mean, a lot of what we're talking about right now really has already ticked some boxes on the what we do for this podcast. So just 15 minutes into it, let me explain for those of you who might be listening for the first time. Basically, the Everything is a Primary Source podcast treats pop culture, in this case a movie, on the same level as a other document of history, like a letter, diary, maybe some kind of artifact that you might find in a museum. We dissect it by using the same kinds of questions to see what it tells us about, in this case, 20 years ago, so 2003. And the first question is the material it's made from, and I think we've covered it pretty well. It's lots of stories. Would you say that, and doing a little bit of research on this, it looked like the writer of it was trying, he was working with a couple different stories, like a few of what we get in Love Actually were already standalone movies, but then he decided to combine them. Do you think that all or most of these stories could be their own movie?
I don't know. I mean, like I said, maybe they could be, but I don't know if that would necessarily improve them. I mean, I think it kind of works the way that you are just getting a glimpse of them, especially the ones that don't have like what we think of as our Hollywood happy ending, you know, mm-hmm. like the whole thing with Keira Knightley and her husband, who she seems very much in love with. But then on the outside, there's the husband's best friend who apparently has been in love with her from afar. Like, if you were to extend that, would we really want to see that? Would we really want to see, like, this poor guy, like, still hopelessly in love with her even after they're celebrating their year anniversary?
Right.
The birth of their first child, buying a home together. Like, do we really want to keep seeing this guy?
Yeah, it probably wouldn't be a comedy.
Well, yeah. I mean, after a while, like, it would really lose the charm. And I guess by keeping it limited, you can kind of hope in your own imagination that eventually he gets over it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he realizes, like, this is not meant to be. My best friend and his wife are very happy. I need to go find my own happiness now.
Like, and he even kind of does that with the famous cue card scene.
Well,
he gives it up at the end.
It's interesting because there's been a lot of chatter online about this movie being rebooted at some point. I don't know how reliable that information is, but it already, you know, occupies a place in our, you know, our hearts, I guess. I mean, I know that there's lots of jokes about, you know, how it didn't age well and things like that. And I'll get into that later. But I mean, I recently have been trying to find some new Christmas romantic comedies to watch. And I watched one that was on Netflix called Love Hard. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, like a pretty typical type of movie, like a girl, you know, is on like a dating app and she connects with this guy and she says, oh, surprise, I'm going to go see him for Christmas. And when she gets there, it's not that guy at all. He's been using somebody else's face But she toughs it out because he promises, like, if you just stay here and help me with this deception a little bit longer because my family now knows who you are, then I will hook you up with that other guy. And there's discussions throughout their movie of, like, throughout that movie about Love Actually. Mm-hmm. And this is a spoiler alert, but at the end of that movie, she recreates the famous cue card scene from Love Actually. So it's like, it's already kind of being rebooted in a way for modern audiences, because if you haven't seen Love Actually, you have no idea what that scene is about.
And I wonder if that's when they decided on the title for Love Hard. I mean, it sounds, it's the same two words, you know, it's love and then something afterwards. And so, this movie came out, I don't want to, it's not by the beginning of the internet age by any means, but as mentioned before, of like that clean, sleek feel to it. The early 2000s had a lot of that where, not for us. I mean, if you remember that time period for us, it was cluttered apartments with wires to different chargers everywhere. And, you know, we never could get our, you know, I was so excited. Remember when I got my first flip phone? Or it wasn't even a flip phone. It was just like a cell, it was a, I think it was like a Virgin pay-as-you-go phone. I was so excited to have a cell phone, and that was around the same time period. And because of that, it's like, here's another plane of the internet age, I guess, early 2000s. And in that era, this is how people met each other. It seemed a lot more organic and real, and as they say in the opening narration, like, it might not always be dignified, it might always look as we want it to be, but love actually is all around. Well, then you go ahead 20 years, because Love Hard just came out, I think, a year or two ago, and it incorporates into it another plane of existence for the internet world, where it's all around us all the time on our phones and dating apps and all that kind of stuff. It is hard. It's very hard to even know if you're talking to the right person. So it's almost like they picked up where this movie left off with that idea of love and then some word to describe what the status of love is in as we get increasingly modernized with all of this. So you're right. I mean, we don't need to go one by one because there's like 10 different storylines all going on in this movie. And somebody actually made a chart of showing where they all cross each other and get tangled up and stuff.
Well, yeah, and when you watch the deleted scenes from the movie, it becomes a little bit more apparent, too, because I guess there was originally a scene where, you know, the character that's in love with Keira Knightley, he, you know, works in an art gallery or owns an art gallery or something, and the character of Mia, who, you know, we're supposed to understand is trying to seduce Alan Rickman, or maybe she is successful and they just don't really show us that part because they can assume that we can connect the dots. She actually sits, because I guess she's friends with him.
Yeah.
And, you know, in the original script, and that scene was eventually cut, but it actually shows her sitting down with him in the art gallery and saying, like, I'm going to try to seduce my boss, like, very, just putting it all out there. And when you watch, when you hear the commentary, I guess they decided to cut it because that seemed a little bit too, I don't know, obvious. I guess on the nose or something. Like, we don't really need to see that conversation. We know what she's trying to do.
She doesn't hide it so, at all.
She doesn't hide it. She makes it very apparent what she's trying to do. But it would have kind of explained that a little bit more as to, like, you know, because that's, she arranges their office Christmas party at an art gallery.
Right.
And I guess the movie, the way it's seen, it seems like it's a coincidence, kind of, or like maybe they kind of know each other marginally.
It definitely takes.
But in that deleted scene, it makes it very clear that they are good friends, so much that she entrusts him to say, like, this is what I'm trying to do right now.
It definitely takes several viewings to start putting the pieces together. Because I'm sure, I don't really exactly remember 20 years ago being in the theater and watching this and thinking, but I don't think I put that together with the art gallery guy, and it just, I don't know, it, like, a lot of those interactions didn't show up until the very end for me. But if you look closely on second, third, fourth viewings, and I think for you and I, we're probably on to about 40th, if it was 20 years,
maybe
at least twice a year.
I mean, I watch it a lot, especially when I had the DVD. This was one of the earlier DVDs that I bought. Actually, just referring back to our earlier conversation, I will say the very first DVD I ever owned was Bridget Jones's Diary. And it was the only one I had.
Isn't that?
And I watched it again and again and again just because the novelty of having my own DVD player.
I remember the intro screen to that had music that had nothing to do with the movie.
And no, but it was a cute little intro, yeah, though. I mean, like, yeah, like little jazzy music and showing little, like, kind of like what we'd think of now as clip art.
Right.
Like, of, like, a scale and, like, a diary and things like that. But, I mean, yeah, that was the first DVD I owned, and then this one didn't come too much longer. And I knew I had to own this movie pretty much as soon as it came out on DVD, too.
A lot of times about 9/11 movies that connect or are connected somehow to September 11th, but and there's the obvious ones, World Trade Center, United 93, things like that. But do you consider this movie a 9/11 movie? I know they mentioned it right at the beginning.
I mean, I don't think I would say it is a 9/11 movie. I mean, they reference it. Because how could you not reference it? You know, it hadn't been that long since it occurred. And like you said, they feature an airport scene at the beginning and at the end. And the airport culture changed drastically after 9/11. Yeah. Like, not just in the U.S. either, all over the world. You know, increased safety measures and a lot more concern and even kind of like paranoia from passengers about what could happen next.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I feel like maybe they already had planned to feature an airport scene, and that's why they felt like they had to kind of mention 9/11, because how could you not? But I don't know. I mean, maybe they just decided to reference it because, like I said, it hadn't been that long since then. And it is, I was thinking about this in terms of, like, the character that I mentioned earlier, the one that's in love with his best friend's wife. And that kind of, like, despair and kind of hopelessness you get from him. And I'm like, I wonder if that's almost kind of like a 9/11 kind of feeling, too. I mean, there is love all around. Like, you know, just because that terrible thing happened doesn't mean that there's nothing good in the world. But we all did kind of have that, like, feeling of, like, you know, we knew we weren't ever going to feel that feeling again of, like, total security. Because how could we ever feel that way again? I mean, we still don't feel that way when, you know, September 11th rolls around.
Well, that's where I was going with it, I guess. It's not that it's about September 11th, but that this movie and its themes were guided by that. Like, that the feeling of, like, I want to make a movie that's, you know, because the cover art for it, the poster of it, it's a wrapped present. It's a gift. It's like saying, you know, it doesn't take much. And, you know, you see all the characters kind of beaming out, and, like, it doesn't take much to realize that love will always be the guiding force and not hate. It won't be, and that we can't allow for people to do that and take that away from us. And, you know, coping with 9/11 on all sides of the both sides of the Atlantic Ocean, I think, was, and it's, you know, I wouldn't say the war on terror is really part of this at all. As a storyline, because, you know, they could have, I suppose. There's a little bit of reference to it by having the prime minister, and he makes a few, you know, references to Tony Blair, you know, the predecessor to him. You know, you assume that he got the job right after Tony Blair. And like we said before about the George W. Bush-esque president rolling into town. And, you know, we got lots of images after 9/11 of British and American flags being woven together, and, like, the opening sequence of the third Austin Powers movie has that inexplicably. You know, there's, like, he does his whole grand intro thing, and then as he's, you know, you see all these British and American flags being waved together, and it was obviously a 9/11 war on terror, you know, our special relationship that they mentioned between the two countries. Embedded in that. So it's not an overtly 9/11 movie, but I feel like the green light for it was given because it's like the counterweight to 9/11. I don't know. That's
well, I mean, I think you can see 9/11 reflected in lots and lots of things, like even sitcoms. If they didn't even mention it, they could still refer to it in a way, or reference Like, you know, we just recently watched the episode of Frasier where, you know, Cam Winston, the upstairs neighbor, has this gigantic flag and it covers Frasier's window up. And they don't mention 9/11 at all. But because it came out shortly after that, and you know that the Angels, I think the David Angel and his wife, they were involved with the production of Frasier. They were on one of the flights.
That's true.
And so, I mean, I didn't know that then, obviously, but I know it now. And they don't, it wouldn't really make sense for Frasier to have done a full 9/11 type episode because they were on the other side of the country.
Yeah.
But they still, you can tell why they're doing that episode. They wouldn't have done that episode otherwise.
Yeah.
But anyways, I mean, that's a little bit of a tangent, obviously. Like,
yeah.
But
I would put this kind of story in Frasier into a similar classification of it's a bit more refined humor. It's not slapsticky in any way. There's much more thoughts involved, and it's, you know, it's a thinking.
It's not slapsticky, although, again, when you go back to some of the deleted scenes, there's some kind of ridiculous stuff that I'm kind of glad they took out. I mean, there's one whole thing with, like, Emma Thompson's son comes home, and he's a little bit upset that he got in trouble at school, and she's like, well, what did you get in trouble for? And he had written a paper about how if he had, like, one wish in the world, it would be that you could see farts. And she was like, what? Like, what? Why would you wish that? And he's like, well, think about it, you know? Then you could always tell who had farted, even if they try to lie about it. And it's this ridiculous, like, little boy type of thing, but it's charming because it seems like the kind of conversation a mother actually would have with her, you know, school-age boy. Yeah. But I'm kind of glad they cut it out because it really didn't match the rest of the tone of the movie. And then the little boy who's in love with the American singer girl, Joanna, there was originally this whole story about how he's like an award-winning gymnast. And the whole time he's chasing her through the airport, he's doing these incredible like backflips and things like that. And it really, again, it really doesn't match the rest of the movie at all. It's totally like ridiculous to think that this little boy is like, I don't know, like flipping all over the airport to avoid the guards. Like it makes a lot more, much more sense for him to just be like outrunning them because he's young and he's after something, you know, but it's just, it seems like there was kind of like a little bit more of a slapstick element to it. And then they made the decision to cut that stuff out.
Yeah. And I'm curious if there's, well, it's because they're trying to meet a lot of different audiences. But to me, that's almost a sign, especially since when I found out that there was only one person that wrote this movie. Like, I could have sworn it was like a effort between several different writing teams, and they all put their own little vignettes together and knotted into, you know, tied it into one big story. But being one person, I think that that's a sign of, by having depth in their characters like that, like a backstory for each one of these people, tells you something about how much effort went into it. And because they wanted it to be a convincing love story. We were talking, you know, leading up to this podcast, that this set off a trend in movie making of trying to make big, sweeping, epic romantic comedies. And the other ones don't really seem to work. I know there's like Valentine's Day was one that came out.
What to Expect When You're Expecting has a similar type of dynamic.
And wasn't there another one you mentioned?
Like intertwined stories. There's one called, I know it has Courtney Cox in it. It's called like Mothers and Daughters or something. Yeah. I watched it years ago, or Mother's Day or something.
Yeah, something.
And it wasn't as many characters to keep track of, but it was still kind of this idea of you're going to watch several different stories of mothers and daughters unfolding. And
they have various levels of success to them, but it's clear that they're trying to replicate this of like somewhere in here, you're going to find some story that you relate to and that you're going to want to follow to its end and see what happens to it as a reflection of your own. This one is successful, I think, because of that depth that the effort it went into to make all these complex characters. So that way, if you do need to take parts away, like cut scenes and stuff like that, it's still really solid story that it's not just, well, that person's stripped down to nothing. Like they have no, no character to them at all. And, that says something, I think, about that time period. I was noting to somebody recently during one of my podcast karaoke things about what I was referring to earlier in this conversation with the use of white, which I guess is no color at all. It's just, you know, blankness.
Well, I think technically white is the combination of all colors, isn't it?
It's not black? Oh, I don't know.
Black, I think, is the absence of color.
Oh, man.
Whereas when you have white light, it is a combination of all the colors, like all the prism, you know. Oh.
Yeah, okay. It's,
did I just destroy your
I guess. It, your well, no, idea. It didn't, because, well, I guess I think of white as a blank canvas. Like, it's blank. It's not. And when you look at posters for movies, when you look at their DVD boxes, early 2000s, there's a lot of white being used. Very simple, even CD covers, you know, things like that. Media in general, I guess. H&M. They all look like H&M stores, you know, just very. And that
is one of my favorite stores to shop at,
and
because
in
I
that
just,
time period too.
I love the presentation of it, you know.
I kind of make a eureka moment with that, because I made that observation with somebody the other day, and I was like, part of me was like, well, that's how the whole time period in Western civilization we saw. As you know, it's very futuristic. It's very, you know, it's like almost like an Apple store or something. Like, everything is just, you know, we're going to hover around on our Segways and everything will be just, you know, perfectly. And I think that might be part of it. But another part of me says it means blank slate, that this is the year 2000. It's the 21st century. This is all a new start for everybody. So let's start with a blank canvas and start painting once again. This movie has there are things that could happen in previous time periods, but it feels very 2000s. It feels very modern.
Well, I like that you say that about like a blank slate or new beginning, because the more I think about the stories that are featured in this, I think pretty much all the stories get a new beginning, right? I mean, like I said, the character that's in love with Keira Knightley, even though they don't show it really, mm-hmm. that he gets over her and stuff, the cue cards at the end kind of make it seem like he's going to try,
mm-hmm.
like, you know, and she even kisses him and he doesn't chase after her or try to make it last longer or anything. He says, you know, enough, this is enough. And then you're supposed to understand that from that point on, he's going to try really, really hard, get over her, find his own happiness. And I mean, like the story that I think is just the most heartbreaking one is the one featuring Alan Rickman and Emma Thompson.
Yeah.
Because it's not like they are, you know, stuck in a loveless marriage and they're bitter with each other or something. You're supposed to understand that they're best friends, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, they enjoy being with each other. They know each other just like any other married couple that's been together that long would. You know, they make little cracks at each other's expense. Mm-hmm. Like when she's like, you know, Joni Mitchell is the woman who taught your cold English wife how to feel. I was like, oh, is that right? I must write to her sometime and say thanks. You know, they make jokes at each other's expense. It's not like they hate each other or something. But he still succumbs to the temptation of the beautiful young girl. And in the process, he hurts one of the most important people in his entire life now. But then at the end, even though you don't know what happens, you don't know, did they get divorced? Are they just trying to be friendly for the sake of the kids?
Yeah.
Or did they try to make another go at the marriage? Because he's returning from some place. I don't even think they say where he went.
Yeah,
but
maybe he went to the United States.
Maybe, but he's coming back. And, you know, she greets him at the airport with the kids. And she, you know, they give each other a little peck.
Yeah.
And they're just kind of like, how are you? And she's like, I'm fine. You know, I'm fine. Let's go home. And but it's like, you know, they're getting a new beginning too. Hopefully it's a good one.
Most of these are all new, new relationships being found, you know, forged. And the scene that's on right now is where the president and the prime minister are meeting. And this creates for a new thing where he, in just a few moments, is going to have a press conference, and you think he's going to say the same thing that every British prime minister since the middle of the 20th century has been saying about their relationship with the U.S. But he has a new beginning.
He takes a stand and he says,
and they say, you know, golden oldie for a golden oldie when they play a song for him. But he lists off all the things that in recent history, especially the British culture has given the rest of the world. It's not just
Harry Potter, David
yeah,
Beckham.
Yeah, his right foot, his left foot, his right foot for that matter.
The Beatles.
Yeah, the Beatles. And yeah, I guess that's not super recent, but yeah, that though all those things, it's like Blink, you know, here's our canvas once again. And oh yeah, United States, by the way, that's why you speak English, is because of us. You know, we gave all these things to you for a long time. The other component, I don't think it's completely different from this whole blank slate attitude thing, is music in this movie and how it's used. And it shows up immediately. It's along with the narration, which is, we assume, the Prime Minister talking. It's definitely Hugh Grant, but we don't know if he's in character when he does the narration or not to introduce the movie. But then as soon as he's done with his narration, we hear Billy Mack, you know, sort of a quasi, you know, Mick Jagger slash, you know, aging rock star guy, English guy.
Yeah. And lots of women, lots of drugs.
Yeah. Rock and roll. They give you them for free.
Bill Nighy. That is like.
Nighy. I don't know if that's how you say his last name or not, but Bill Nighy, is that?
I always just said it Nighy.
Nighy. And he's doing this awful and admittedly terrible, you know, Christmas song based on.
By my festering turd of a record.
And he says, as he keeps screwing it up, he's like, I'm just so familiar with the old version. You know, all I know is the original one.
I just know the old one so well.
So it's like, we're watching them trying to make new art based on old stuff. And so I think it's all very thematic, and it extends beyond this movie. It's like that blank slate that I think a lot of us were searching for, that it was honestly very much 9/11, going back to that, was almost like the most horrific way to derail that kind of feeling of this is the future and here we go. Because it was just like, well, that just ended all these hopes and dreams that we had, quite literally, for thousands of people all one day. And they won't join us in the future. I don't want to get too down, though, but that seems to be. And then this scene that you were mentioning before, Joni Mitchell, she pops in the CD later on to listen to it, and music shows up again, and it's Joni Mitchell covering her own song. She's doing a jazz, like, you know, bluesy,
like a very kind of mournful,
very melancholy version. Because you hear the original version recording from the 60s, and it's a sad song, but it's a bit more upbeat, and
it's much more folksy, obviously.
Yeah,
but this one, like you said, is kind of
from both sides
melancholy.
Now. And now it's like her gravelly voice. She's aging. The cover of the CD shows her like smoking a cigarette, not looking like the Joni Mitchell flowery child of the 60s. You know, it's like, and then the scene that's on right now is when Hugh Grant, which apparently he hated this scene. He said it was awful because he kept having to do it over and over again. And he doesn't like dancing, I guess, and we can kind of see why. But having this song by Girls Aloud jump in and, to kind of represent. I still remember the trailer for this movie, and they featured this part a lot in it, making it seem like he just dances his way through the movie.
They're kind of hearkening back to the character that he played in the Bridget Jones movies, because, Daniel Cleaver is very much like the comedy of that movie. It's certainly not Colin Firth, he plays, the Mr. Darcy and of Pride and Prejudice.
Man,
the straight man. And it's Daniel Cleaver who's playing, Wickham, that character of like, oh, I'm funny and I'm charming and I'm adorable, but I'm not actually the nicest guy. And I think, even though the Prime Minister is not meant to be like that character, I think they were trying to kind of get audiences like, oh, remember how funny he was in Bridget Jones's Diary? Like, now you can see, some new antics from Hugh Grant.
Oh, he's hysterical. in all these movies, and he just has that perfect dry sense of humor where he just kind of throws little things in there in all of his dialogue. We haven't talked at all about, and I said we wouldn't go through every single storyline, but this one with Aurelia and Jamie, Uncle Jamie. This is a movie I'm like, oh, that's Colin Firth. It's the older guy from What a Girl Wants. Oh, I get it now because he's pretty funny. And, you know, so I guess they're in France, right? This whole storyline is taking place where he's writing his crime novel. And,
Again, like you said, it's not that I necessarily need to know the whole backstory of every single character, but I've always wondered about this. I'm like, are we supposed to understand that he is a writer and he's working on a new book?
Yeah.
Or is he something else and this is just like an indulgence for him? Like, everybody kind of has nursed that dream of like, I wish I was a writer.
I get the sense because when he goes to the cabin, the woman that is like the caretaker, the landlord or whatever, seems to know him. And it's like he goes there.
Yeah, but that doesn't necessarily mean that that's his career, though.
I don't know.
Just because he has a house there, he could be... Because he also says how bad his writing is.
Yeah. And
again, that could just be a writer's self-critique, but maybe he realizes that it's almost kind of like an indulgence.
I guess we don't need to know.
No, we really don't. Yeah. It's always hard for me to choose my favorite love story of Love Actually. And... You know, I love Colin Firth. I've been a huge fan of him for a long time, even longer than I initially realized, because I remember when I was in elementary school, we watched a film version of The Secret Garden, which, of course, is a book that I adore. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize until years later that he plays the grown Colin.
Man, he's just always Colin, isn't he?
Well, yeah, I mean, Colin Craven and...
Yeah.
And I think they changed the dynamic there a little bit in that film version because it's like they're not cousins in that film version. It's just that like Lord Craven is her godfather instead of her uncle because otherwise it would be weird that she ended up falling in love with her cousin.
Yeah.
But yeah, at the end of that film version of The Secret Garden, he comes back from World War One and it's Colin Firth. And I remember thinking like, oh, wow, you know, he grew up pretty nice. And then I didn't realize until years later, I was like, oh, that's the guy. That's the same guy. I've apparently had a crush on him since I was in elementary school. And I didn't realize it. I do have his autograph. Many, many years ago, back in the days of Live Journal.
He had a Live Journal?
I belonged to a Colin Firth fan group on Live Journal.
I didn't know if you
and
had
it was all just people posting about Colin Firth movies. And there were some people that had written to him and they had actually gotten responses from him. So, of course, they updated about it. And so I tried it. You know, I said, okay, I'm going to try this. I'm going to send a letter to Colin Firth. And sure enough, I got back an autographed photo of him. I didn't get a letter back. I would have actually kind of preferred to get a letter back, but by that point, his popularity was quickly increasing. I don't think he had time to write letters.
The message
to
on the picture, which we still have displayed, but
yes,
the message on the picture is about the most Colin Firth message around. Like, it's like, Aaron, best regards. It's
like, something like that. Finest regards. And I mean, it is kind of like a treasured thing of mine now because it wasn't too long after I got that. I wonder if that still happens, if they can write to him, if his address is even available anymore, if they still get autographed pictures back, because I mean, that was before the King's Speech and everything, you know.
And all of these other things he's done since then, he's become.
But anyways, I mean, I love Colin Firth, but I think if I really, really had to pick my favorite story, it would actually be the one with Billy Mack and his manager.
Yeah.
Because I like that they include that one so much because it's not romantic at all. It is like a lifelong friendship. When you see the same person every day and you really kind of take them for granted, you know? And he recognizes, like, wait, this person has been with me through the best times in my career, but also through the worst times in my career. And he's never wavered. Like, he's, you know, it's... And so he chooses to leave the glitz and the glamour of Elton John's party and go sit in the little apartment that his longtime manager has. And as the camera kind of pans away from them, you just kind of see them like, joking around and probably reminiscing about all these crazy things they've been through together. And I think that would actually have to be my favorite one. Just the idea of friendship and long time.
Knowing
each other being a form of love.
The critics gave this a pretty tepid response. And one of the biggest criticisms of it was that it was just trying to do too much with all these stories. But I still go back to it saying, no, I think it's fine the way it is. And because they don't really settle, I guess if we had a stopwatch out and timed each story and just saw how much screen time it got, we probably could decide which one is like the leading story kind of thing. But that one that you were just mentioning just says it all again of like how we don't need the full backstory. We, as soon as we meet both those characters, we know enough about them. Like, we get this idea of this guy is like, you know, he's probably popular starting in the 60s and 70s and stuff. And now he's just like a fixture in pop culture.
But he's resigned himself to doing these like cheesy covers and publicity stunt type things. And
his friend is the producer, manager guy, whatever, is just kind of there like, Yep, we'll just do it again, you know, as long as it keeps us both solvent for a while.
Yeah.
And then they're surprised that he's getting popular for the song. And we get the song plays several times throughout the movie. And then by the end, you get
I have the song on my Christmas playlist.
And after a while, doesn't it just go back to the original song? It doesn't even
Starts out saying, you know, Christmas is all, but then, yeah, by the end of it, they're just going back to like, love is all around. And it's kind of brilliant because it's like, it actually is like Billy Mack. And halfway through, he just gave up. And
yeah. One of all the songs, the original one is very much the theme of the movie, you know, the way it describes it. Speaking of songs in this movie, I think we were discussing this also before we recorded this, that Mariah Carey's All I Want for Christmas Is You is probably the most reviled song. I don't agree with that necessarily. I think it's overplayed, but when you listen to it after 11 months of not, you're like, this is a great song. It came out in the early 90s, right? Mid-90s? Probably 10 years before this movie.
Yeah, because I remember when it came out, it was... I remember being really jealous because my best friend when I was growing up got it and it was on tape. It wasn't even on CD yet. It was on tape. And I know that we were kind of young, so it didn't seem weird to us that it was on tape. It was just like, well, of course it's on tape. That's another way to listen to it. Yeah, I mean, I feel like it was a little bit before the age of everything being on CDs.
I would think that this movie is probably responsible for it being revived. And it's such a fixture because it plays its central role in the movie. And music, like we've been saying, it drives this movie. It's not quite American Graffiti, where it's like a character in the movie necessarily, but it's a presence in it. And by having Joanna at the end of the movie singing that song, and I remember being in the theater, seeing it for the first time, and when, you know, they introduce that she's going to sing it, and she starts in, and I'm like, oh, yeah, I know this song. I didn't know it super well, but I was like, oh, I'm familiar with it because by 2003 and all the Christmas, you know, about the 9 or 10 Christmases that the song had been around, you'd hear it periodically, but it wouldn't be necessarily. And I think this movie really has a big role in making her the queen of Christmas. So I think that we've pretty much hit on all of the questions without actually saying, here's the question, you know, just our conversations, which confirms to me why I wanted to do this podcast a couple years ago to begin with, because you and I have long had these kinds of conversations, whether it be driving in a car, which would be unsafe to podcast while you're driving, or just after we watch a movie or something like that. And it just kind of flows with it. You don't necessarily have to go one question at a time and answer all of them. One thing that we didn't really do a lot of, but is just the where was it made and locations associated with it. When Colin goes to America, and I think that's my favorite of the storylines because
Wisconsin.
Yeah, he's like, I'm Sir Colin. Daw, darling. When he, you know, in the way his friend Tony is just like talking him down, he's like just telling him what a huge mistake it is. But why do you think that they chose? Do you think they? It doesn't show. Let me get my thoughts together. I remember this thread. I'm like, okay, so you have American actors in this. And, you know, Laura Linney being the most prominent one. But it just seemed like they didn't really understand America too much. They, like, threw a dart at the map and, like, yeah, Wisconsin, we'll just have... And then he goes to a... And, you know, Wisconsin, anywhere in Wisconsin, he goes there and the first thing he orders is a Budweiser. But, you know, Milwaukee is Miller. You'd think they would have that. It just seemed, like, very random. And, like, none of the people that he interacts with look like, I don't know. I've never been to Wisconsin, so maybe everybody there is like, I don't know. It just seemed like very randomness to it. Did you feel like that was lazy, that they just kind of threw him in Wisconsin? Why do you think they put him in Wisconsin?
Well, I think they just kind of put him there because, like, obviously he doesn't know America.
Yeah.
So, like, and we're supposed to understand that he really doesn't have much money. He wouldn't have been able to stay very long in a place like New York City or Boston or LA.
Yeah.
He had to pick a place that was affordable in Wisconsin.
And
you know?
That he'd be super exotic.
Yeah, exactly. Like, he wouldn't be that exotic in LA or New York even.
A lot
but
of
like,
English people, yeah.
Yeah, but in Wisconsin, you know, the way the girls all reacted, like, oh my God, are you from England? You know?
Yeah. All right. You just destroyed my, or totally explained it in a matter of seconds.
Well, I did want to go back to one thing, though, that you were talking about the music earlier, and you neglected to mention that, you know, the Billy Mack video of Love Is All Around is the Addicted to Love, basically,
yeah.
That music video. I mean, it's obviously a little
well,
bit sexier
yeah, Robert
than the
Palmer
Addicted
has,
to Love video, but it's
he did
definitely
a few,
the,
and
a
then,
reference to that.
And Shania Twain did a version of it, too. Man, I Feel Like a Woman. I don't know
oh,
if it was
yeah,
before
right.
or after this movie, but she, that those...
No, I think hers came also before this movie.
Yeah, I like that video. But it was like, you know, they, because he had, I think it was Addicted to Love, and there's another one that's like basically the same song, it's the same video, like from Robert Palmer, from, you know, 80s, the models and everything, playing the instruments. It's like, and so it's like just taking off that and, you know, teasing it out. I have a question for you. And in the 20 years since this movie's been out, we have...
Wow, I can't believe it's been 20 years.
That's why we're doing it.
Oh, my God.
And actually, it's a little bit late because it came out early November.
Yeah, I guess I mean, you said it was 2003, and I know that it's 2023 now, but I just... It's so hard for me to think of this movie as 20 years old.
Well, and this movie came out just before social media really took off. I think MySpace is around, but before
I
Facebook,
know LiveJournal was.
LiveJournal was definitely there, and the Colin Firth connection was there. YouTube didn't exist, and so people weren't making YouTube videos where you and I poke fun at it all the time, and we challenge each other to make fan videos with fan theories about things that don't exist just to mess with the internet. But there have been a lot of fan theories about this movie ever since it came out. Do you think there's anything supernatural involved in this?
Well, I mean, it's not like that's an unheard of trope in Christmas stories at all. So it makes perfect sense that they might put an allusion to that in there. I mean, obviously A Christmas Carol has... three, you know, the ghosts of Christmas
yeah.
past and present and future, not to mention Marley makes an appearance. So there's actually like four ghosts.
And old man Marley in Home Alone.
And,
which
he's
realized,
not a ghost.
But no, but I just realized why they named him Marley.
Oh, well, yeah, I think the namesake is there, but yeah. like, he's not a ghost. But
as far as you know, we could make a new fan
theory
right
now. But I mean,
right
there is, that's true. But there is the Victorian tradition of, you know, telling ghost stories on Christmas to kind of reinforce this idea of, like, you know, enjoying life while you're here
yeah.
and things like that. And, and what else was I going to say? Oh, shoot. I totally blanked. There was another
I'm
example.
Still fixated on that. I'm like, yeah, actually, I think Old Man Marley is a ghost because nobody else seems to see him.
Oh, well, obviously, duh.
Except
it's a Wonderful Life has an angel
oh, yeah,
in
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, there it's not unheard of at all to have supernatural type things around Christmas time. So it's perfectly reasonable to think that maybe they made it unclear on purpose. Because I do love the idea of the, what's his name? Rowan Atkinson.
His character's name is Rufus, apparently. Yeah, I didn't know that until tonight.
I mean, he does seem to kind of play a pivotal role in two of the stories.
Yeah.
And he doesn't even seem to realize it. Or maybe he does realize it, because when he's walking away in the airport, he kind of gives, you know, Liam Neeson's character a little...
Oh, and Family Man is another one.
Oh, yeah, and Family Don Man Cheadle's also character. Has, you know,
and they, that one
like
I
a
love
guardian angel type of thing,
they
too.
Don't even, they're so ambiguous about it. They're just like, the people, you know, the organization's really impressed by you. And, you know, I love how they kind of mask it. And that's another movie from similar time period where it just kind of has supernatural undertones, but they don't harp on it.
Well, I don't know.
No
if
pun
the
intended
Rowan
with an angel, but
you totally intended that.
I did not actually.
I think you don't always realize that you intend it, but I think you always.
I'm just
them.
Winging it.
I think that you're.
Hello.
Oh, you're just in heaven right now, aren't you?
I'm on cloud nine.
All right. Anyways, what I was going to say is that I don't know if he's necessarily intended to be like a guardian angel type of thing, but I like to think that he is, because, you know, the whole jewelry store scene, yeah, or jewelry counter scene, I always kind of felt like it was him trying, like he's taking his time on purpose.
I didn't even think about that until
because
recently.
Because he's trying to show, you know, the Alan Rickman character, like, look.
What you're doing is
maybe
mistake.
You should take a minute and think about this. You could be making a huge mistake, which of course he is.
Right.
And well, we all know it.
I think that,
you know, this best dramatic irony there could be. We all know he's making a huge mistake.
And then his wife catches him. Oh, you're at the jewelry counter.
Yeah.
That's my best Emma Thompson.
And then, of course, he kind of gets in the way at the airport so that, you know, young Sam can go chase after Joanna.
Yeah.
And he, like, for someone who says he forgot his ticket or his passport or whatever, he's like, oh, I must have left it where I was having a cup of coffee. He doesn't seem concerned at all.
He just, like, wanders back.
He just gathers his stuff and calmly walks away.
I'd
like,
be
if
frantic.
I left my
yeah.
stuff in an airport, like my ticket or my passport or whatever he's referencing, I would be frantic, like running out of there. Like, but he doesn't seem bothered at all. So
yeah.
It almost seems, again, like he's doing it to give somebody a moment.
Right.
And hopefully the best possible, you know, thing comes out of it.
And I think that it was, and again, that's like, you have to watch this movie a few times for that to really click. The
and
first
you know,
time I saw it,
I'm
it
sorry
didn't.
To interrupt, but they just, we're at the scene right now where, you know, Harry is, you know, dancing at the Christmas party with Mia. She's wearing devil horns.
Yeah.
So it kind of makes sense
yeah.
that they're kind of making her
angels
like a devilish
devils.
Type of character.
Yeah. Like, who wears that?
That would
to,
be a foil to that, which is like an angel.
Who wears that to a Christmas party?
Well, yeah, and I always thought that was weird, too. I'm like, you know, who wears devil horns at Christmas time?
But then she ends up sort of redeeming herself later on, and she doesn't realize it, but when the Prime Minister, David, right, is looking for
Natalie.
And he's going house to house on the dodgy end of the street. He ends up at Mia's house, and she's the one that's like, she lives next door.
Well, yeah, you know, but if he's really going house to house, he would have realized that anyways.
I guess so, but he may have given up soon because, you know, anyway. But she kind of helps, and she's not, but I never liked
but
that
But isn't
character.
She wearing the necklace when she answers the door?
She might have been, yeah.
I don't know, we haven't come to that scene yet.
Yeah, she's... I mean, you probably won't in this recording because we're already at the hour point.
Address before we get off then.
Yeah,
I know
you
that,
mentioned before about things that didn't age well.
Well, I see posts pop up on social media all the time about, you know, the best Christmas movies, the whole Die Hard Christmas movie
yeah.
thing. I could care less about that, honestly. But I always pay attention to the ones about Love Actually because, like you said in the very beginning, we did see this movie in the theater together when it was first released, and it's always kind of been our tradition to watch it. It's something that we really look forward to doing. and I have a really special place in my heart for this movie. And I recognize that, you know, obviously anything that's 20 years old is going to have a little bit of problematic things in it. Whether, you know, whether it's the technology that didn't age well, the special effects that didn't age well, something about a storyline or a character that didn't age well. I think the two parts of the movie that people seem to think are the worst is the one that we already talked about, the man who's in love with his best friend's wife. People feel like, you know, that comes off kind of like stalkerish now. Like, it's not charming or romantic to have those strong of a feelings for your best friend's wife. Like, you know, I'm not saying that I don't think it's a super realistic storyline. I mean, maybe he would have had a crush on her at some point, but to really feel like he's hopelessly in love with her after all that time, and, you know, like, wouldn't he have gotten over it at some point?
Well, that's one of those stories I think they should have done a little bit more back, you know, just to establish why he loves her so much.
Maybe, but I guess it seems like it's mostly a physical thing.
Yeah,
because the way that, you know, he's constantly zooming in on her at her own wedding.
Yeah.
Like, he's constantly zooming in on, like, her face, her eyes, her lips.
Yeah.
The way that she, like, turns her head when she walks away and things like that. It seems like it's probably mostly a physical thing rather than, like, actually knowing her as a person. Because, as they say, he doesn't really know her that well. He never took the time to get to know her. And she doesn't think that he even likes her because he never talks to her.
And he also works in an art gallery, and where the show that's being, you know, all the, it's a, you know, photography exhibition. I had so much trouble saying
of that. Nudes, basically.
Of nudes. And he is, you know, they're not funny. They're art. You know, he's like, seems to be, and just hit me. I'm like, yeah, he's a lot more interested in just the form and the shape and not actually the person.
Yeah.
You know,
that's a good way of seeing
and
it.
And it's like, he's,
and it kind of explains it a little bit more, I guess.
But yeah, so that part, yeah.
Yeah, it
like doesn't, if they made the movie now, they might not have had it, they wouldn't be putting that in there.
Yeah, the other thing that people tend to point out a lot is all the remarks about Natalie and her body, and you know, the chubby girl. Like, she, you know, no one's gonna fancy a girl with thighs the size of big tree trunks, and even her own dad calls her plumpy.
Yeah,
he's like, "Come along, plumpy," and I'm like, when you look at the actress, like, she's a beautiful woman, and I mean, she's curvaceous, but I wouldn't even necessarily call her full figured or anything. I mean, she's
kind of normal looking.
Yeah, well, I mean, in contrast to some of the other people in the movie, like, you know, Keira Knightley is very, very petite. Laura Linney's fairly petite too. Like,
I think that
she's fuller than them, but I mean, I think that that's the point that a lot of people kind of feel sour about now is, and I don't even remember liking it then. It's not like back then it was permissible and now we don't like it. I remember even back then a lot of people feeling kind of like, you know, it's a great movie, except I wish they wouldn't keep calling her fat because, you know, we've come a long way in terms of accepting different body types, and
that's a very British thing, I think that's more of a reflection of British culture at that time, maybe just in general, of what they understand as overweight or, you know, unhealthily, that kind of thing, because I don't think I'm 100% Anglophile, but I do watch enough British media to get the feeling that they do have much different body standards in their, you know, they are constantly making fun of Americans for our very unhealthy diets and, you know, the fat intake and stuff like that in this side of the Atlantic. So,
like, our, I think in general, most of the world sees the U.S. as being obsessed with consumption of all forms.
Yeah.
We consume everything. You know, we want to consume food and drink all the time. We want to consume media all the time. We just consume the economy. Like, we consume everything, basically.
Well, Finding Nemo came out, and that's an American movie that came out the same year as this, and there's that part in that movie where, you know, probably Americans, you know, and the sharks are talking about, you know, Nemo being taken away, and they think they can have it all. And
yeah,
and that was very much of the era too, of All Eyes on America, War on Terror, you know, all this kind of commentary about it. And, but that part with the British of, I guess they probably had to have it in there because I don't know if they had to have it, but I don't know, to make him seem like he is awkward with women or something, that he doesn't always, I don't know. Like I remember as soon as she showed up on the screen, the first time I saw this, I was like, yeah, I like her. You know, she fits exactly. And then later on when his sister is like, oh, you better watch out. You know, 20 years ago, you're exactly the kind of woman that he would have gone for or something like that. And I'm like, well, wouldn't most guys be interested in a gorgeous woman like this? Like, I don't see why she's so odd in that regard. But so I guess it's more of a reflection of their culture at the time. And yeah, that didn't really cross over to our culture as well then or now, as far as Love Actually being. Cause I think most people are like, yeah, of course. And that's what the American president likes her. You know, goes over.
That's true,
and, you know, he checks her out as she walks past. He's like, that's a, I forgot how he puts it, but.
Well, I think one of the things he says is like, that's a pretty little son of a bitch right there.
Yeah.
Which is like, oh, okay.
Do you think that this is a good document of 2003? That we can look at this and be like, okay, I want to know what.
Well, every time I watch it, I'm kind of transported back to 2003, which is, like I said, it's kind of hard for me to think that's 20 years now, yeah. Because there's always this joke about, you know, people our age, like elder millennials type, kind of being like, oh, the 2000s? Like, it's kind of new. Like, that was just the other day, and we're like, oh, no, it wasn't. We're almost in 2024 now.
I still think the 90s think of just anything happened.
Yeah. Exactly. Like, oh, the 90s? Like, that was like, you know, 10 years ago. So, I mean, it does kind of transport me back pretty much immediately.
But I think there was such a concerted effort in all the media in the early 2000s, and maybe in our real lives too, of it wasn't the 90s extended. It was like a new era, and this is how we're going to behave now. This is how we're going to dress now. This is how we're going to act now. This is how we're going to approach everything now. And that in itself seems dated here in the 2020s, when we look back 20 years ago. Oh yeah, one last thing I was going to say that this movie did for me is it rekindled my interest in the Beach Boys, because the way the movie ends, it starts with a narrator, doesn't end with a narrator, but the Beach Boys with God Only Knows at the end, I'm like, wow, I didn't remember how great the Beach Boys are. You know, they're not just surf, fun type music. They had, like, probably one of the greatest songs ever written. It's
like a ballad.
Yeah, and it's a beautiful song, and it's so, like, genuine and real. You know, like the opening lyrics of it is like, I may not always love you. It's like, that's, you know, either I'm not always happy with you, or we might not be in this relationship forever. You can take it whatever you want to mean it as, but it's like, just that message of like, I can't be anybody without you as my partner. And for you and I, this was very early in our relationship. We hadn't been together for a full year when we saw this movie together, and yet, and I don't know if you want to believe this or not, but I remember watching this and that song at the end and feeling like our story could be up there someday in one of these Love Actually type vignettes. I don't know what you think about that.
Well, I don't know if I was thinking it then, but I do feel like, not specifically for this movie, this might be an idea for a future podcast for you, but whenever I watch When Harry Met Sally, yeah, and they have all the different couples talking about how they met, I feel like that will be us someday.
We have to do that one soon, because it's like 1988, so that'd be 35 years ago. So that's round numbers only for fives and zeros is how I'm doing things from now on, so I gotta hurry up and do that. Maybe that's what we do on New Year's Eve, because we always watch that movie on New Year's Eve. And it's, yes, like that was another surprise movie for me. It's like how much I liked it, because I remember you had me watch it and I was like, oh, this would be romantic comedy, and then 5-10 minutes into it, I'm like, this is like Seinfeld, like same, yeah, kind of humor.
I mean, we should save this for when we talk about, you know, that, but I remember you said that and I was like, oh, I think that's it exactly. It was like Seinfeld before Seinfeld.
Right. And Love Actually is sort of like Seinfeld after Seinfeld, where it's the tied up stories, they all meet each other at some point, and a lot of this is mundane, ordinary life type stuff that happens, especially if you're not the prime minister of one of the biggest economies in the world. All right, Aaron, thank you so much for your willingness to do this, and any last things you want to say about Love Actually?
I wish I had something, you know, really great in closing, but thanks for having me again.
Every day we are in the same room, so we should probably do these more often, but thank you again. I love you. If there is such a thing as a sweeping romantic comedy epic, it is Love Actually. It was this feature of the movie that simultaneously attracted audiences and, unfortunately, repelled critics. Trying to do too much, especially in a normal comedy film length, is the main criticism. But fans of the film have long felt that Love Actually meets its ambitious storytelling at just the right point. The first few years of the 21st century was the time to try new things, with media of all sorts, including rom-coms. The genre had become rather stale throughout the 90s, but Love Actually writer-director Richard Curtis had already demonstrated what could be done with the romantic comedies as early as 1994 with Four Weddings and a Funeral, making him the right person to give a 10 intertwined storyline picture at the right time for fresh starts, the early 2000s. Love actually is all around this holiday season, and everything is a primary source. Happy holidays, everybody.